The Irish Times and Irish Independent both lead today with Brexit-related stories. The Times reports that DUP opposition to a potential solution hardened last night as the EU and UK warned that there was still a significant amount of work needed to reach a deal. We're told that hopes of a compromise being agreed in time for this week's EU summit faded yesterday as sources in Brussels expressed deep scepticism that a compromise solution could be sufficiently developed in time to be put to EU leaders on Thursday or to MPs at the House of Commons next Saturday. For its lead story, meanwhile, The Independent reports that if a late Brexit deal does emerge, the Taoiseach will come under intense pressure to call a snap general election, since many TDs in his own party believe that they would do better in an early contest instead of waiting until next spring or summer. The killing of 53-year-old Timothy Horahan, who was found unconscious near the burnt-out tent he had been sleeping in at Mardyke Walk in Cork in the early hours of Sunday morning, is the lead story in today's Irish Examiner and Echo. The Examiner quotes Catriona Toomey of Penny Dinners in Cork, a service which Mr. Horahan attended, saying that more homeless people will die unless the government increases its efforts to tackle the crisis. In its coverage of that story today, The Times reports that Gardaí investigating Mr. Horahan's killing believed that he may have been assaulted by more than one person. The Irish Daily Star, Irish Daily Mirror, Irish Sun and Herald all lead today with allegations related to an assault in Dublin over the weekend. Draft legislation on the new online regulator, which is due to be published before Christmas, is expected to include a levy on tech companies. That's according to the lead story in today's Irish Daily Mail. For its lead story, the Irish News reports that abuse fears had been expressed about the behaviour of staff at Muckamore Abbey Hospital 7 years ago. The care facility for adults with severe learning disabilities just outside Antrim town is currently at the centre of a PSNI safeguarding investigation, which has resulted in the suspension of 33 staff. The Belfast Telegraph leads with a new medal for PSNI officers, recognising them for working under the threat of terrorism. Back in the front of today's Times, the paper runs with a picture of an elderly man being evacuated from a building in a town near the Turkish border with Syria after it was hit by a rocket reported to have been fired from within Syria. And that paper also reports that Lisa Smith, the former Irish soldier who became a supporter of Islamic State, may have fled a detention camp in Syria over the weekend. And finally, although Ireland's World Cup victory in Japan on Saturday dominates the pictures in today's sports supplements, the commentary is all about our quarter-final match against the All Blacks next Saturday. Ireland attempt to scale All Black Mountain with spring in their step is the headline over Jerry Thornley's piece on the front of the sports supplement in the Times. While over on the front of the supplement in the Examiner, the question is posed, has Smith another trick up his sleeve for Barrett's New Zealand, alongside the headline, Black Magic.
To Syria next, where Kurdish leaders in the north of the country say that the Syrian president, their former opponent, has agreed to send its army to the northern border to stop an attack from Turkey. Turkey say they want to make their border secure from Kurdish terrorists. Kurdish fighters had helped the US to clear the area of so-called Islamic State fighters. Dozens of civilians and fighters have been killed. Thousands of people are fleeing the area. The US has ordered its remaining troops to withdraw. And Kurds say that hundreds of relatives of IS fighters have escaped from a detention camp where it was believed Lisa Smith, a former Irish soldier, and her daughter were being held. Michael Young is a senior editor at the Carnegie Middle East Centre in Beirut. We can speak to him now. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
What is Turkey's strategy here?
Well, I think what the Turks ideally would like to do is to essentially create a security zone along their border with Syria, stretching from Afrin in the west all the way towards to the east, you know, I think the area of Ras El Ain, in other words, the area which they basically started occupying last week. And then they would like to, it seems, to place perhaps over a million Syrian refugees in this zone. So effectively, they want to create a security zone, but what this would involve, if their plans succeed, is a complete re-engineering of the population of this area. It would be a larger Arab population, and this would act, I think, as a barrier to, as they see it, the Kurdish threat from northern Syria.
And what would that mean for Kurds, especially now after looking for help from the Syrian government?
Well, obviously, you know, the fact that the there are two developments in the last 24 hours that are actually interesting. First of all, the Kurds, as you said, have come to an agreement with the Syrian regime, and Syrian troops would presumably be heading north to that area. Now, the second thing that has not really been discussed, but it's interesting that there have been reports that the Russians have said that they would enforce a no-fly zone above that area of northeastern Syria. Now, if that happens, effectively what this could do is make it much more difficult for the Turks to go through with such a plan. I'm not saying that the Kurds would be able to in any way to defeat them, but without air cover, you know, you would have, it would be a much more grueling contest. So the point is that whether the Turks can actually carry through this plan of putting in well over a million refugees in that area is questionable at this stage. You know, we suddenly have a much more complicated situation in which the Russians are apparently taking a position. And this will, in a way, shape, I think, outcomes on the ground.
In your view, Michael, could IS become resurgent as a result of what's happening in the area?
Well, obviously, that depends a lot on what actually happens. Certainly, if there is chaos taking place, there is fighting between the Turkish army and the Kurds, and you've got the Syrian regime entering the fray, it's going to be, indeed, on the ground, it will be confusion, and they will be able to take advantage of that. But you know, we're in a different situation than we were in 2014. We're not talking about a situation where there is a vacuum here. You have a lot of armed forces in that area.
Yes.
So while there is definitely a definite risk that of an ISIS resurgence, but we're not dealing with the situation that existed at the time. You know, where you essentially have a vacuum. In which it would be easy for the group to, you know, establish, they may be able to establish areas of control, but whether they can expand as they did before is a more questionable issue.
If they're unable to exert control over an area, as you said, that is being fought over by many different parties, where would or could prisoners go?
Where could the prisoners go?
Yes, those who are escaping.
I mean, you know, today there's no real clear, there's no real clear sense of where the prisoners will go. Some of them are hanging around. I've been put in the Al-Hol camp, which is to the south of where the fighting is. But there are prisoners in other areas where there is fighting, who reportedly have fled. You know, it's really a free for all. So. And there's no real atmosphere today to try to organize, something dealing with the prisoners. I think as far as the Kurds are concerned, and as far as the Turks are concerned, the issue of ISIS has become a secondary issue at this point. You know, their focus now is on fighting each other, and on the Kurds, the Kurdish focus is on surviving.
Michael, thank you very much for speaking to us. That's Michael Young, senior editor at the Carnegie Middle East Centre in Beirut. We'll hear more from Turkey later in the programme. 25 past seven.
There's renewed doubt this morning about the chances of a Brexit compromise being reached in the short term. Discussions on London's latest proposals are due to continue today. Under the new plan, Northern Ireland would be in the UK's customs area, but would in practice operate as an EU customs territory. Last night, however, the EU downplayed the prospects of an early breakthrough. Our Europe editor Tony Connolly is on the line from Brussels. Tony, another important week, and I know we've said that many, many, many times. What are you hearing about what's been happening behind the scenes?
Well, Rachel, there have been intensive negotiations over the weekend following that meeting last week between Leo Varadkar and Boris Johnson, and all of that sense of a breakthrough. But those discussions so far have yielded quite a bit of doubt on the EU side about the British proposals. And it's worth just pointing out that going into this negotiation, the EU has taken as its preferred option the original Northern Ireland-only backstop. In other words, in the event of no other solution being found, Northern Ireland would stay in the customs union and the single market to avoid a hard border. The British proposal is quite a distance from that. Northern Ireland would be in the UK's customs territory, but it would apply EU tariffs and procedures. So if goods were going to Northern Ireland only, they would pay the EU tariff when they crossed from Great Britain into Northern Ireland. But if the EU tariff was higher than the UK tariff, then importers would get a rebate. So the benefit of that is that you would have no need for customs checks on the island of Ireland, but you would have this system that would kick in. And if the goods were going on to cross the border into the south and by extension the rest of the EU, then their original EU tariff would be the correct one. Now, when they've discussed this over the weekend with British officials, I think the EU side have just seen that this would be incredibly complicated to operate. You would have to have a system of tracking all the goods to make sure that they end up where they're supposed to end up. There's a fear that this wouldn't be done on time, because obviously everything has to happen by the end of the two-year transition period, which, because of the delays to the extension to Brexit coming into effect, is only 14 months away. And there are also concerns about fraud. And finally, there's what we call rules of origin. So goods might, like sugar, might go to Northern Ireland, but then might be an ingredient that goes into another product, which crosses the border again into the EU 27. So these are the problems that the EU side have identified. And ultimately, the EU is kind of saying, look, we need to get things back towards the original Northern Ireland only backstop, which is legally much more operable and simple, rather than going into this mishmash of a UK plan, which frankly the EU thinks is just not really going to work and would again cast a doubt on the integrity of the internal market.
I'm glad that the EU negotiating side thinks that all of this is a bit complicated, because I think for many of us trying to get our heads around this over the weekend, it certainly wasn't an easy task. Tell us, Tony, if you can, what's likely to happen over the next few days, because, of course, the summit is almost upon us.
Yes, so I mean, the choreography of this last week, I suppose the sunnier version of it was that there was this breakthrough, there would be intensive negotiations, and it was possible to get a deal by the summit, or at least by the end of the month. Now, the way things are looking following the weekend's negotiations are certainly casting doubt on that, because if the UK persists on this particular model of avoiding a hard border on the island of Ireland, then it would take, frankly, months for this to be worked out, and certainly not in time for the summit. The EU side are, as I say, pushing to sort of slide the UK back towards the original Northern Ireland only backstop. But of course, that comes with a huge political price for Boris Johnson, and he may not get it through the House of Commons. So what's going to happen is that negotiators are continuing their technical talks on these issues. There's also, of course, the whole consent issue, which we haven't really got into, and they will continue, and Michel Barnier will take a decision probably on Tuesday, perhaps Wednesday. Now, on Tuesday, tomorrow, he's going to brief member states in Luxembourg as to the state of play, and they will then have to decide whether his mandate is that he can bring forward the plan to the European Council, or whether more time is needed, or whether it's just not really going to work out and that we will be heading towards a much more serious scenario, perhaps a no deal at the end of October. Although it's important to say, of course, that the UK law prohibits Boris Johnson from taking that particular course of action.
As you say, though, there are big questions as to whether he could get any revised agreement through the House of Commons. And there are also serious questions about the position of the DUP. Jim Shannon, the MP, is quoted in this morning's Irish Times as saying, if we're not being treated the same as England, we're not going to accept it.
Yes, I mean, the initial holding statement from Arlene Foster last week, the DUP leader, was kind of a wait-and-see approach. You could find language in there that was taking a more pragmatic approach. But of course, over the weekend, we had Nigel Dodds, the deputy leader, talking about anything that meant that Northern Ireland wasn't fully out of the customs union was not really going to be a runner. And given that the UK proposal leaves Northern Ireland in a kind of a halfway house, then if he follows through with that kind of warning, then the DUP are not going to accept this. And if the UK is nudged further backwards towards the Northern Ireland-only backstop, which Theresa May agreed to, then it's hard to see the TUP at all accepting mm-hmm. this. And of course, the DUP are what they call a canary for the hardline Eurosceptics in the Conservative Party. If the DUP like it, then groups like the ERG, European Research Group, would accept it. So Boris Johnson is facing all of these pressures. Again, we're going to have a big day next Saturday when the House of Commons sits to decide on what happens at the European Council. We have the Queen's speech today as well. So there's an awful lot of churn happening, and it's really hard to see from this vantage point how this is all going to play out by the end of the week.
Tony, thanks indeed. Tony Connolly, our Europe editor in Brussels at 20 past seven. Investigations will continue this morning into the murder of a man in Cork City. Timothy Hourihan, who was originally from West Cork, was beaten to death. He'd been living in a tent on Mardyke Walk. Katrina Toomey of Cork Penny Dinners, which provides food and support to homeless people in the city, is in our Cork studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
You knew Mr. Hourihan. This must have been a really sad and disturbing weekend for you.
Yes, it is. And we're deeply saddened and we're hurt by it all, and this is where we're going to stand firm now and plead with, I suppose, our Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, to step in and to do something. We're losing too many people. There's too many people on our streets. The homeless crisis is really over the top. We've been talking about this for years, and we've been telling the government that something needs to be done, and this, you know, what happened over the weekend has caused untold grief for a family out there again and untold grief amongst the homeless community. But when we're talking about the homeless community, we're not just talking about the rough sleepers, the people that have to sleep out that can't get in anywhere. We're talking about the people that are in B&Bs and in hotels, the families. Very little has been done. And now we know that it's, we're going to lose more people because of the government's lack of interest in this problem, in solving the problem. It can be done. There's a workable solution out there, and we would appeal again.
When you say, Katrina, that there is a workable solution out there, I know homelessness has become more and more of a problem in Cork in recent years. What, in your view, is the solution?
It's not just housing. We need treatment centres, and we need support services. The people that work in the support services here in Cork are very good, but they're all stretched. So we need a lot more. You have people going into treatment centres and they come out and they're homeless again. So how can that help them heal? Do you know, the whole situation has to be looked at, and we've got to put a full package together. We have a revolving door. It's the same for when people come out of prison. They're back out and they have to present at the homeless services. So again, they may commit another crime to get back into the prison just to have some place to stay. And so if you're looking for a solution, the government needs to sit firm with those at the front line. They need to listen for once and for all to what we're saying, and they need to put that plan in action. But they need to be doing it now. We're not talking about next year or the year after, because every year we come back with the same story to the government. Please solve this problem. We need it solved, we need it sorted, and we need it done now.
I know you don't want to dwell on the circumstances of Mr. Hourihan's death, but no. Can you tell us a little about him, and also can you tell us about the area where he was living? Are there many people sleeping there?
There are a lot of people up there, and I suppose they went there because it's off the beaten track, so to speak, very near the city so that they can access services, but it is off the beaten track, and they probably felt that they were safe up there. Again, when you have a load of people staying in one area, that can be a recipe for disaster in itself, you know, because people have a lot of frustrations going on. They have a lot of difficulties. There's a lot of issues going on. And you can't just leave people hide themselves away. We see the fear and the frustration. We see the tears. We see it all. And they're totally frustrated up there. And they're wondering how long more they're going to be there. They're actually in a field like that's waterlogged at all times, because it just, the rain will just soak the whole place. So can you imagine having to, you know, be there night after night after night? And the less visible they are, the less visible the problem is. So the government, you know, aren't looking at it. Mm-hmm. But we see it and we feel it.
As you probably know, that money isn't the issue here. No. That there is money for whatever needs to be done. So So in the short term, I mean, I know many people will have been shocked by what happened at the weekend. In the short term, what can be done?
There are lots of houses for sale around the country. Buy them up, put the families in there, start freeing places up. There is a huge amount of money being paid to the hotels and the B&Bs for the families and for individuals that are in the hotels and B&Bs as well. And that money could be freed up to buy housing and use more money like that the government would have to buy any houses that are out there for sale. There's for sale signs on houses all over the place, turnkey, and people could move in. We have to look at more hostels, but smaller hostels, you know, that are easier to manage and not to be lumping a load of people together, whereby all with different issues and complexities like are all together, and that again could be another recipe for disaster. You end up managing it and controlling it rather than using it as moving forward, you know, and helping the person that's in there. So we again need smaller hostels or smaller, you know, complexes for people, like, you know, apartments, you know, one bedroom apartments for those that aren't ever going to be married or have a partner or, you know, have anybody with them. There's a huge shortage of that, and something could be done. There are buildings around the place where there are apartments. Right. So we would just urge the government to, you know, and the Taoiseach to lead us out of this at the minute and to look at the state of our mental health and at our addictions and the underage drinking. Everything is boiling over here in Cork, and it's very hard. And the Gardaí need more resources here in Cork. They're appealing all the time for that. So do the medical services. And they're appealing and appealing and appealing. And that shouldn't be happening. These are our frontline services that should have what they want and what they need.
Well, listen, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to talk to us this morning. That was Catriona Toomey of Cork Penny Dinners. It's 7:31.
Activity in the construction sector contracted for the first time in over 6 years in September, according to Ulster Bank's Purchasing Managers Index. It was mainly accounted for by a fall in commercial activity. The housing sector continues to post growth, according to this survey. New business growth declined to its slowest pace in over 6 years as Brexit weighed on customer demand. Half of businesses here have cancelled or postponed investments because of Brexit, according to AIB's Brexit Sentiment Indicator. In the north, that figure is 66% of companies. While almost 60% of businesses in the Republic expect a hard border, just 32% of businesses in the north expect that outcome. The G7 group of nations have jointly warned that cryptocurrencies like Facebook's Libra pose a risk to the global financial system. A report from the world's seven biggest economies says the Libra project must not go ahead until Facebook proves that it's safe and secure. Currencies, the euro is trading at $1.103 and 87.5 pence sterling.
7:38, Darren Frehill is here with the sport.
Good morning, Rachel. Well, we're going to start with rugby news, and Bundy Aki will appear before a disciplinary panel at 11:30 this morning, and he is going to learn his World Cup fate. Sent off, as we know, against Samoa at the weekend. Ireland meet New Zealand in the quarterfinals next Saturday, and if suspended, the ban could well end his World Cup tournament. More on that in an hour. But what about New Zealand? Johnny Sexton has been talking to RTÉ Sport about the challenge ahead. Michael Corcoran caught up with him earlier this morning.
It's a huge challenge. You know, we knew that no matter if we got out of our pool, who we got was going to be huge, a big task. But it's when we can produce our best performances when there's more asked of us. And hopefully we can do that again this week.
Is this almost like the ultimate test?
100%, yeah, that's clear. You know, they're the best team in the world over the last, I think over 10 years they've been number one in the world. So for us it's the biggest challenge. They've had some sort of continuity in personnel with their coach and staff as well. So they've got experience at the World Cup. But, you know, we know that come Saturday night that none of these things matter. It's who plays better on the day that can get the result. We know we have to play close to our best, or we have to play our best to get the right result.
That game is live on RTÉ Radio next Saturday morning, 11 o'clock. Do tune in for that. Irish manager Mick McCarthy says he's open to starting Aaron Connolly for the big European qualifier against Switzerland tomorrow. David McGoldrick has not recovered from his groin injury. The Irish team have two games left. The game against the Swiss tomorrow, and then we're home to Denmark next month, and we need to win one of those matches to progress to the 2020 finals. It's as simple as that. The Irish manager says he is surprised with some of the criticism of the Georgian game. He's been speaking to FEI TV.
I don't get it. I really don't get it. I think everybody would have took the position they're in now. Going to Switzerland, and if we win, we qualify. If we beat Denmark, we qualify. of course, the peddlers of doom and gloom will say, well, we've no chance of winning. I don't get that. Who knows? Who knows what will happen? You know, we've been all right. We've played better against the better sides, actually. We've been better performances. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, we all are. That's tomorrow, live on 2FM and RTE2 Television. Former footballer and regular contributor here to Morning Ireland, Paul Corry, joins me on the line. Paul, ask you first of all, the criticism. Do you think Mick has a right to feel aggrieved?
I do, Darren, and I can understand why he does feel aggrieved. You know, we still sit top of the group. We're unbeaten. We haven't conceded many goals. We look like a well-drilled, well-organised side. I just think from a fan's point of view, we probably expect more against the likes of Georgia. Our ability to retain the ball was quite poor the other night, and we really struggled again to create chances. So that was disappointing in itself. But I think as a whole, and as you look at the group, we sit in a good position. We know our fate given the last two games, but we will definitely need higher levels of performance if we're to get out of this group.
Now, what about Aaron Connolly? We know David McGoldrick is not available. We know the impact Aaron made when he did come on for the last 10 minutes against Georgia. Do you start him tomorrow night?
I would. I think when you look at the final third, Darren, and what we offered against Georgia, we didn't really give an awful lot. I think James Collins struggled up there, and James Collins hasn't got the legs to run in behind defences and cause them problems. And I think when you look at Aaron Connolly and his game, he does that. I think he will start. Whether he starts up top or whether he starts out wide is probably the question. But definitely somebody who can offer something different, and maybe just somebody who can run in behind defences and relieve a bit of pressure, because looking at this Swiss game, we're not going to have huge amounts of the ball, and maybe it's a counter-attack is our best route to go.
And if we were to get the 3 points, which game do you think we'd get them in?
Most likely the Denmark game. You know, Switzerland are the 11th top side in the world, and they were really, really good against Denmark the other night. So I guess either way, Darren, if you look at it, if we're to get a result, we're really banking on another clean sheet and probably a goal from a set piece.
Okay, Paul, thank you very much. It wouldn't be Irish soccer if we qualified with a game to spare, really, would it? So I think we'll have to wait for that game against Denmark next month. Fionnuala McCormack has qualified for the Olympic Games with her 5th place finish at the Chicago Marathon. Personal best time, 2 hours, 26.47 seconds. Incredible stuff. But what about the winner? Bridget Koshgai smashed the women's world record, 2 hours, 14.04 seconds. 16 county finals played yesterday. So many great stories. Do you know what? We could be here till the end of the show talking about the first timers.
A county final show.
Maybe we should. It was one of those extraordinary days. You can read all about them on the RTE News Now app and RTE.ie. But I do want to highlight Six Mile Bridges' big win against their neighbours, Cratlow. Tim Crow, the manager. And what we found out yesterday was, well, those of us outside the county, there was a big falling out with Davy Fitzgerald, his coach of that Six Mile Bridge team. Well, he's been explaining how he and Davy got on board together and how it was key yesterday.
Myself and Davy had a difference of opinion for about 11 years, but it's a lesson for all clubs. You know, the sad thing is we should have mended bridges a long time earlier, and maybe our club would have benefited. It's a total community effort, and we all have our roles to play, and I'm just fortunate that I have the glamour role this year.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure about glamour role, but
a difference of opinion for about 11 years.
There's a life lesson there. That's all your sport for now.
Poland's governing Law and Justice Party has claimed victory in the weekend's general election there. An exit poll gave the Conservative Nationalist Party over 43% of the vote, enough to take a majority in the lower house of parliament. Polish citizens living in Ireland voted at the Polish embassy in Dublin. According to the last census, there are over 120,000 Polish people living here. Let's speak to Rafał Kipuszewski. He's English editor of the magazine Polish Market. Rafał, good morning. Thanks for taking our call.
Good morning.
A clear winner, it seems. Why have they won?
The victory is not as much as they were expecting to. They were hoping for an overall majority which would help them to carry out more reforms of the Polish constitution. And the actual number of percentage of votes that they got according to the latest votes is even more than you said. According to early returns from the Electoral Commission, it's 45%. So it's not enough to rule as decisively as they would like. The reason that the Nationalist Party has gained so many votes, according to the opposition, is that they got a large proportion of the Polish population on their side due to a program of extensive family subsidies and other measures that, well, the opposition says basically bought many votes.
Poland is a relatively well-off country now. Do people feel that benefit?
Well, you hear that, and of course it's a shining example of how market reforms in Eastern Europe have worked well, but the wealth hasn't trickled down to many sectors of the population, and hence there are still those families, especially in the east of the country, which have treated the government handouts, as the opposition called them, a blessing, and that seems really to have made the difference. So when you go to Western Poland, countries, lands which are closer to Germany, where people have more access to the German market, where they can go and have more opportunities, that's obviously making more of a difference. In Eastern Poland, it's a different story. It's these are largely depressed areas, and people are more traditional there, and they will be voting for the ruling party.
Rafał, why did gay rights play such a big part in the election, and what effect will the result have for gay people living in Poland?
The issue was actually generated, the opposition says, quite artificially by the ruling party circles, in conjunction with the powerful Roman Catholic Church. The gay rights were on the way up until the victory of the Nationalist Party 4 years ago. Now there's a bit of a setback with that, because there's been a campaign of basically equating homosexuality with vices, with all those things that the traditionalists would say, and there's no way that the Polish the general Polish public can have a clear picture of what's right and what's wrong in this issue.
Rafał, thank you very much for speaking to us. Rafał Kipuszewski, who's English editor of the magazine Polish Market. It's 7:47.
You're with Morning Ireland. The first meeting of the new Beef Market Task Force will take place later today. It was formed as part of the agreement under which farmers agreed to stop protesting outside meat plants. For more, let's talk to our agriculture and consumer affairs correspondent, Fran McNulty. Fran, a brief reminder, first of all, what was this dispute all about?
It was about beef prices, the price which farmers, Rachel, are paid for their cattle when they present them for slaughter. Prices have been declining. The meat industry says that's because of weakening demand. It's because of oversupply in Europe. But farmers were saying, we simply cannot continue to run on viable farms. We need a better price for our cattle. And so they held protests and blockades outside plants in order to bring some attention to this.
So who's going to be there this morning, and what are they trying to do?
They're trying to do is implement what was agreed. These talks went on, these disputes, these blockades went on for weeks and weeks, Rachel, and eventually Minister Michael Creed called everybody around a table and said, we need to get this sorted. They held marathon talks, they reached an agreement, and this task force is about implementing that agreement and making sure everything that was committed to is done and is completed. And that's what it's about. It's about greater transparency, looking at pricing, looking at how the industry is structured, and all the farm bodies, the meat industry and state agencies should be around the table here at the department in around 3 hours' time.
Now, there are some complications in all of this, and one of them is this. Farmers are saying that they still have legal actions hanging over their heads.
Yes, three named individuals say that injunctions are still hanging over their heads. Now, part of the agreement, Rachel, when these talks concluded, was that all of the blockades would end, that the factory gates would be cleared, that the meat industry could get back to normal. You have to remember, the meat industry, the beef industry here, virtually ground to a halt during these blockades. But the quid pro quo for that was that the meat industry, the factories, had to withdraw any legal action or threats or injunctions against named farmers. Three of them are saying over the weekend, we still have injunctions out against us, and we expect this to be tabled directly by the Beef Plan movement today. The Beef Plan have drafted a letter to the chairman of the talks, Michael Dowling. They are asking for letters of discontinuance to be issued to these farmers. In other words, for the meat plants to say this legal action applies no longer. And there is an indication this morning that if that doesn't happen, the beef plant may not take part in the talks. And there's also an indication that some farmers are on their way to Dublin as we speak to protest outside the department.
Fran, thanks indeed for joining us this morning. That was Fran McNulty, our Agriculture and Consumer Affairs correspondent. It's 7.51.
Now, there may have been positive soundings about developments Brexit-related in recent days, but businesses are continuing to plan on the basis of a worst-case scenario. According to AIB's latest Brexit sentiment indicator, half of companies here have postponed investment and around two-thirds have concerns about the future of their business. Catherine Moroney is head of business banking with AIB. She's here now. And the index, Catherine, makes for very pessimistic reading, but I suppose we have to view it in the context of the messaging that was coming out of Europe and London at the time, and it wasn't encouraging.
That's true. First of all, this is the ninth quarter of the survey, and at the time it was in field in mid-August all the way through to September. Sterling was very weak, at its weakest from August 17, and also the Prime Minister was talking at that point, remember, about leaving without a deal, and it was before Parliament had passed legislation to prevent that, so it was a very uncertain time for everybody.
Is the level of negativity consistent across the economy and across businesses, or are some industries more impacted than others?
They are, and the sentiment really reflects the various impacts that are expected by each sector. So, for example, the most pessimistic at this point was manufacturing. The sentiment goes from minus 100, which would be the most negative you could be, to plus 100, which would be the most positive. And manufacturing was at minus 59. And one of their concerns, obviously, is when they are exporting, and the manufacturing sector has a lot of exports into the UK, when sterling is weak, they are less competitive, so their price points are less competitive, which they have experienced. And the next most negative would have been transport at minus 57. And there in transport, they're really concerned about disruption to their free-flowing business at the moment. Remember, at the moment, they're going across all borders, north, across to the UK, over the land bridge into Europe, with a very smooth business model, and there is a serious threat to that even in a soft Brexit.
So a lot of the effects at the moment are sterling related, and we've seen that not just in the last few months but over the last few years, and there was a bit of a bounce in sterling in the last few days. Should companies capitalise that on that now, and how can they go about doing that?
Yes, that's really important. So sterling, for example, we see a trade in and around a range of between 85 and a sort of 90-ish, but it has gone as strong as 82, and it has gone as weak. At points it has gone up to 95, and sometimes even it's gone close to parity. And the critical thing for businesses, I would say, is first of all, look at your natural hedge before you pay for hedging. So if you've got inflows and outflows in sterling, try to match them in an account so you're not paying for an exchange rate. And then after that, it's definitely a good idea to smooth out your profits. So to bring that down into stark figures, a 10 basis points move in sterling could cost a business almost 13,000 euro on a 100,000 euro sale. So very few business can sustain that kind of swing in their net profit.
Just to look at some of the figures in the survey, about 4 in 10 businesses here, over half in the north, haven't made any preparations. Is that concerning, or are they just holding off until they know what they're dealing with, essentially?
It is concerning, but it's also understandable, because they are saying, why would I spend time and money, which is very precious to a business, on a plan when I don't know what's going to happen? But what I would say at this stage, the call to action right now is, no matter what Brexit looks like, once Britain becomes a third country, there are changes that we already know are definitely going to happen. So a couple of key things businesses should be doing right now is making sure if they're using the land bridge into Europe through the UK, they have to get their registration number now. They have to get their customs documentation. They're going to need transit guarantees. They take time. So what I would say now, rather than focusing on a plan, get into action mode if you're transporting goods, either export or importing, from or to the UK or through the UK into the land bridge. That's critical.
Catherine Moroney, Head of Business Banking with AIB, thank you very much indeed for that. More business news at 8:30. And now it's back to Gavin.
8:04. Let's get a weather forecast now. Elizabeth Coleman is at Met Aaron. Morning, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Gavin, and good morning from Met Aaron. So our weather quite wet today and unsettled for the coming week. And there is a yellow rainfall warning in effect today for Munster, Connacht and much of Leinster. For more details in your area can be found on our website met.ie. Cloudy today with heavy and persistent rain in many areas and the potential for localised flooding. There's also a risk of some thunder. Later in the day, drier conditions will extend into the west and southwest, but further spells of rain will continue elsewhere. Highest temperatures of 10 to 14 degrees. Winds will be mostly light to moderate and variable in direction, but strong and gusty along south and southwest coasts. Further outbreaks of rain tonight with some heavy falls at first, but the rain becoming patchier overnight with drier weather for most areas by morning. Mist and fog will form widely in near calm conditions. Lows of 3 to 7 degrees. And the mist and fog will slowly clear tomorrow morning with some sunny spells developing. Largely dry across the country at first. However, wet and windy weather will move into the west and southwest by early afternoon. And this will gradually extend countrywide by evening. Highest temperatures of 11 to 15 degrees. And light southerly breezes will back southeasterly and freshen with strong and gusty winds along southern coasts, where the rain will be heaviest. The rain will clear eastwards overnight on Tuesday, with scattered showers moving into the west. Many areas will stay dry for the day on Wednesday, with sunny spells and moderate southerly breezes. However, showers will affect Atlantic coastal counties, and some of these will move further inland through the day. Highest temperatures of 11 to 14 degrees. And looking ahead to the end of the week, a steering low in the nearby Atlantic will feed in bands of showers with blustery southwest winds up along the Atlantic coastlines and some thundery downpours. The best of the dry and bright weather will occur across the eastern half of the country, and temperatures will reach the low teens at best. So to recap on today's weather, heavy and persistent rain with the risk of some localised flooding, with drier conditions moving into the west later today. That's your forecast. Have a great day.
Good morning. It's exactly 8 o'clock on Monday, the 14th of October. This is Morning Ireland with Gavin Jennings and Rachel English. With the news in detail, here's Brian Jennings.
Negotiations between officials from the European Union and the United Kingdom are resuming in Brussels. EU leaders are expected to consider a deal on the withdrawal agreement with a modified Irish backstop later this week. Our Europe editor, Tony Connolly.
After 2 days of intensive discussions, the EU's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, briefed member states yesterday afternoon on the state of play. It's clear both sides remain far apart on customs. The UK pitch is for Northern Ireland to remain in the UK customs territory, but to apply the EU's rules and procedures on tariffs and quotas. That way, a customs border would be avoided on the island of Ireland, but Northern Ireland's legal position as part of the UK customs territory would be unchanged. Goods going from Great Britain to Northern Ireland would attract the EU tariff, but if they were staying in Northern Ireland, then the importer would get a rebate. If they went on across the border, the EU tariff would be the correct one. However, officials say the UK plans create more problems than they solve. Tracking goods, working out a system of rebates, avoiding fraud would all be highly complex and probably not ready in time for when the transition ends. Tony Connolly, RTE News, Brussels.
In Britain, MPs will return to Westminster for a new session of Parliament this morning, following a 5-day suspension. The session will be formally opened by Queen Elizabeth, who will set out the British government's priorities, including legislation needed for the UK to leave the European Union. The UK Parliament will sit on Saturday to assess any deal that might come from the European Council meeting on Thursday. Our London correspondent, Sean Whelan.
A government without a majority and teetering on the brink of a general election will nevertheless set out its legislative priorities for the coming year today amidst the pomp and ceremony of the state opening of the United Kingdom's Parliament. Some 22 pieces of legislation are to be included in the programme, written by the government but read out by Queen Elizabeth. Among them, the EU withdrawal bill, required to ratify any agreement reached with the EU, and legislation to end free movement by EU citizens after 2021. Sean Whelan, RTE News, London.
Kurdish leaders in northern Syria have reached a deal with President Bashar al-Assad, their former opponent, to send troops to counter a Turkish invasion. The Syrian army is to deploy its soldiers along the border with Turkey to help the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces. Earlier, the United States ordered its remaining troops in the region to withdraw. Yesterday, Kurdish forces said nearly 800 relatives of so-called Islamic State fighters had escaped from a camp after it was bombed by the Turkish military. In an interview with the BBC, the former British Foreign Secretary David Miliband, who now runs the International Rescue Committee aid agency, said ordinary people were caught in the middle.
There are war crimes against civilians, bombing of civilians who are fleeing. There is also grave danger to children, but also that the winners out of this look like the Islamic State group ISIS and the Assad government.
The inaugural meeting of the new Beef Market Task Force is being held later this morning. The task force was one of the main outcomes of an agreement reached last month after dozens of meat plants were blockaded by farmers. State agencies and farmer representative groups will take part in the task force, which is expected to address pricing and transparency. Our agriculture and consumer affairs correspondent, Fran McNulty.
The recent agreement led to the introduction of new bonus payments for quality assured cattle. Some existing bonuses were also increased. These payments are now being made to farmers, but disquiet continues about how factories are dealing with pricing. This beef market task force has a wide remit and many hope it will provide scope for scrutiny and reform. But the big sticking point this morning is a claim that three named individuals are still subject to legal injunctions by meat plants. Lifting blockades and legal actions were two of the central planks of the recent agreement. This morning, the main farming bodies are insisting the issue is resolved immediately and legal threats withdrawn. Meat Industry Ireland has told RTE News that the commitment to withdraw legal proceedings has been honoured by the beef companies concerned. RTE understands there will be an insistence that all legal action from whatever source against farmers be withdrawn before the task force can proceed. Whether or not it even gets off the ground today is far from sure.
A man whose body was found close to his burning tent in Cork City yesterday morning has been identified as Timmy Hourihan, a native of Bantry. A murder investigation is underway. Mr. Hourihan was a chef who had worked abroad for a number of years before returning to Cork. It's understood he had been homeless for some time, having failed to get accommodation after a number of attempts. Tens of thousands of rescue workers are searching for survivors of Typhoon Hagibis 2 days after the storm struck Japan. Local media are reporting that the storm resulted in the deaths of at least 35 people. Now the time is 6 minutes past eight.
RTE Radio 1 weather with ESB Networks. Working on a construction site? Stay clear of overhead wires and underground cables. For emergencies, call 1850 372 999.
There'll be heavy and persistent rain in many areas with the potential for flooding and a likelihood of thunder. Later in the day, it'll become generally dry in the west and southwest, but further spells of rain will continue elsewhere. Highest temperatures will range from 10 to 14 degrees.
Brexit, the killing of a homeless man in Cork, and Ireland's quarter-final challenge against the All Blacks in Japan next week are some of the stories which you'll find covered on your front pages this morning. The Irish Times leads with the line that DUP opposition to a potential solution to the Brexit deadline hardened last night as the EU and UK warned that there was still a significant amount of work needed to reach a deal. For its lead story, meanwhile, the Irish Independent reports that if a late Brexit deal does emerge, the Taoiseach will come under intense pressure from TDs within his own party to call a snap general election. The killing of 53-year-old Timothy Hourihan, who was found unconscious near the burnt-out tent he had been sleeping in at Mardyke Walk in Cork in the early hours of yesterday morning, is the lead story in today's Irish Examiner and Echo. The Examiner quotes Katrina Toomey of Penny Dinners in Cork, a service which Mr. Hourihan attended, saying that more homeless people will die unless the government increases its efforts to tackle the crisis. The Irish Daily Star, Irish Daily Mirror, Irish Sun and Herald all lead today with allegations related to an assault in Dublin over the weekend. Levy on tech firms to fund new watchdog, that's a lead story in today's Irish Daily Mail, related to legislation on the appointment of an online regulator, which is expected to be published before Christmas. For its lead story, the Irish News reports today on the PSNI investigation into abuse claims at the Muckamore Abbey Care Facility for Adults with Severe Learning Disabilities in Antrim, which has already resulted in the suspension of 33 staff. Back in the front of today's Times, it's reported there that the former Irish soldier Lisa Smith may have fled a detention camp in Syria over the weekend. The Independent has a front page story about how some personal injury lawyers are warning clients who are in the process of making a claim to keep their social media postings private and to be careful about accepting friend requests from people who they don't know. Elsewhere this morning, a number of papers report on the injuries sustained by 9 members of Enniskerry GAA Club who had to be hospitalised after they fell off a truck they were standing on celebrating their win in the county championship. Many of the players suffered broken bones and some of them are expected to require surgery. Recent storms have resulted in an unprecedented number of Portuguese man-of-war jellyfish washing up on the coast of Cork and Kerry. The Independent, Examiner and other papers this morning report on this story. A number of today's papers also report that Google has been granted planning permission for a sports pitch on top of its building at the former Boland's Mill site in Dublin as part of a €300 million urban regeneration project. The Independent carries an artist's impression of what the enclosed pitch will look like. The Times reports today on a new bill which would ban the sale of e-cigarettes to under 18s and also on proposals to introduce stricter regulations on the provision of cosmetic procedures such as Botox and dermal filling. And finally, although Ireland's World Cup victory in Japan on Saturday dominates the pictures in today's sports supplements, the commentary is all about our quarter-final match against the All Blacks next Saturday. The lead editorial in today's Independent reminds us that it's also a big week for our soccer team, who are playing in Geneva tomorrow night following their nil-all draw against Georgia on Saturday. Sporting showdowns offer welcome break from gloom, is the headline there.
We were talking to our Europe editor, Tony Connolly, earlier, who was telling us about why hopes are fading of agreement on the border on this island after Brexit. Britain is due to leave the EU in 17 days. Both sides say they want to avoid border checks on this island. The EU believe the best way to achieve that is for Northern Ireland to remain in the EU Customs Union. London want all of the UK to leave the Customs Union, but for the North, in practice, to operate as an EU Customs Territory. And, as our Europe editor was telling us earlier, EU negotiators are not clear how or if that will work. But this morning, here's Simon Coveney sounding more positive, arriving at a meeting of EU foreign ministers in Luxembourg.
The message I would give is that we need to be cautious. This is not an easy job. We've spent 3 years trying to get an agreement between the two sides that have made progress at different times, but certainly the last number of months have been difficult. So I think, you know, as my Taoiseach has said, a deal is possible, and it's possible this month. May even be possible this week. But we're not there yet.
That's Simon Coveney speaking in Luxembourg this morning. Mary Lou MacDonald, president of Sinn Féin, spoke with the British Prime Minister for half an hour by phone yesterday. She's on the phone to us now. Mary Lou MacDonald, good morning.
Good morning, Gavin.
What did he say to you?
Well, he said that he wishes to seal an agreement. He says that he understands that there can't be a border, a customs border, on the island of Ireland. He says that he understands and supports, indeed, the notion that the Good Friday Agreement needs to be protected, championed, implemented. But what he can't say, Gavin, is how to square, therefore, the circle of supporting all of these things, of affirming all of the commitments that have been made to Ireland to protect our economy, our jobs, our peace, and on the other hand, insisting against the democratic will of the people of the North that they exit the single market, the customs union, the EU. Tony, and that is the big conundrum. I mean, I put it to him, Gavin, that we've had 3 years of not just shadow boxing, but of a really, really dangerous strategy adopted by the British state and by the Tory government, which has really been quite reckless, which has caused now for the clock to wind down. And we're now in the last furlongs of this Brexit episode, and we are still no clearer. And he has to understand the level of anxiety, disruption and economic damage that has already accrued to the island of Ireland. He says he wants a deal. Let's see if that's possible. He didn't give me the answer to that question as to how you maintain a seamlessness on the island of Ireland, how we protect our economy,
okay,
how we protect our people and protect Good Friday if he still insists that that the North must exit the customs union.
Tony Connolly was explaining to us earlier that the EU are having difficulty trying to get their heads around how this proposal will work. Do you understand what the pathway to a deal is?
No, I don't. I do understand, and I want to say I welcome very much if this is in fact a real substantive negotiation. I said that to the Prime Minister yesterday. If this is finally his government and the British state engaging in good faith, in goodwill, and in a serious and substantive way. Obviously, I'm not in a position, as you'll understand, Gavin, to judge finally whether this is real or not, because I'm not party to the detail of the negotiations. But what I can say is this, is that they have not identified, or certainly I haven't heard, how the customs issue is resolved in a way that is acceptable, in a way that is legally operable, in a way that is enduring for the island and that would protect Irish interests. I have, like yourself, heard the speculation and the leaks and the accounts from third parties, but I think it's only when, if and when we see the colour of London's money and what they've actually put on the table, that you would be in a position to make a final judgment on that. I raised with him the issue of consent. It is very, very clear that any proposition to afford unionism or the DUP a veto over the protections that are required, not just for the North, but for the entire island of Ireland, would be absolutely unthinkable. He sought to reassure me that, that is not something that he is pursuing.
On consent, what role do you see Stormont or a Stormont executive having in any Brexit deal?
Well, I think we need to be just to bear in mind that the referendum on Brexit in the North, the adjudication of the people was to remain. So there has been no consent to Brexit. I think we have to bear in mind that there is very, very widespread cross-community support for the backstop, for the Irish Protocol, for the protections that we all know are necessary for business and agriculture and society and the Good Friday Agreement. Those that are at odds are outside of that view are the DUP. And as I said to you, the idea of giving a veto
in terms of seeking consent now, what role do you see Stormont or the Stormont executive having?
Well, at this point in time, I think that is a sideline issue, because if there is no agreement, if we cannot agree the substantive protections for the island, if we cannot land on protections that are legally operable, in other words, that are of the real world and that can come into force, if there can't be agreement on those provisions enduring, in other words, things that are not time-bound or temporary, well, then the issue of consent, to be honest with you, is a theoretical one. I actually don't understand fully what is meant by seeking the consent of the executive or the assembly, except to say and to repeat to you again that we will not entertain or allow for any form of veto for unionism to hold the island of Ireland to ransom. That's simply not going to happen.
Mary Lou McDonald, President of Sinn Féin, thank you for speaking to us this morning. It's almost 20 past eight.
A week after Donald Trump announced that US soldiers were leaving northern Syria, the Kurdish authorities have asked their former opponent, President Assad, for help. The deal, which the Kurds hope will thwart the Turkish invasion, will see the Syrian military returning to the country's northeast for the first time in several years. Since the Turkish onslaught began, 130,000 people are thought to have left their homes. Amid the chaos, hundreds of Islamic State sympathisers escaped from a detention camp. The Ain Issa camp was where the Irish woman Lisa Smith and her daughter had been living. Journalist Jasper Mortimer joins us now from the Turkish side of the border. From the Turkish side, what can you see?
Well, there's been intense fighting in the Syrian towns across the border of Tel Abyad and Ras El Ain for the past 2 days. We've seen Turkish howitzers shelling those two Syrian towns, or at least the Syrian Kurdish positions in those two towns. We've seen the puffs of white smoke as the shells explode. We've also heard rockets go going across. And we've also heard heavy machine gun fire, which is presumably the Syrian Kurdish militia firing at Turkish troops. Occasionally, from the Syrian side, a mortar has landed in the Turkish town. One mortar fired from Syria landed in Akçakale, the Turkish town across the border from Tel Aviv, yesterday morning. Blew a hole the size of a lounge window in the side of a building, but injured nobody. However, something like 18 Turks have been killed by mortar shelling from the Syrian side since this conflict began on Wednesday.
Can you remind us, why does Turkey say it's taking this military action?
Officially, it says because there is a terrorist corridor along its southern border that is intolerable, and it plans to wipe the terrorists, who are the Syrian Kurdish militia, according to the government, out of that corridor and use the corridor to set up a safe zone into which it can resettle up to 2 million of the Syrian refugees now in Turkey. But there is a problem there, because most of the Syrian refugees in Turkey are ethnic Arabs. However, the northeast Syria is a Kurdish heartland. And to put that number of Arabs into a Kurdish heartland would change the demographic balance. And this is why the EU has come out strongly against the Turkish plans to resettle the refugees in that zone, saying it will not contribute to the cost of their resettlement because demographic change is not to be allowed.
What's known about this unlikely deal between Syria's Kurds and President Assad?
Well, it's known that the Syrian Kurds have agreed to hand over control to the Syrian government of three large towns in northern Syria for which they fought tooth and nail against the Islamic State. These towns are Kobani, Manbij, and Raqqa. Now, Kobani is right on the Turkish border. It's one of the towns in the so-called terrorist corridor that President Recep Tayyip Erdogan plans to flush the Kurds out of and take over. So I can't believe that the Turkish army will be very happy to see the Syrian government move in there. Also, Manbij, which is further inland from the border, Turkey has been vowing to throw the Kurds out of that town and take it over itself for years now. So it looks as if there is now a race between the Turkish army and the Syrian government forces to take over Kobani and Manbij. Now, even if the Syrian government forces manage to avoid a head-on collision with the Turkish army, even if the Syrian government forces just support the Syrian Kurds, allowing the Kurds to tackle the Turkish army, I imagine the support the Syrian government gives to the Kurds will include the Russian tanks and heavy weapons that the Kurds don't have now. And this will certainly strengthen the Kurds' firepower. And so the fighting is likely to intensify.
All right. Well, listen, thank you very much indeed for talking to us this morning. That was Jasper Mortimer there, journalist joining us from the Turkish side of the Turkish-Syrian border. It's 8:24.
The country's third largest airport, and up until recently was on an upward growth trajectory. But Shannon Airport is experiencing turbulence. Last year, 1.7 million passengers used the airport. This year, that figure is likely to be significantly lower. The grounding of the Boeing 737 MAX alone has cost the airport 120,000 passengers as airline Norwegian cut its transatlantic routes. And last month, Ryanair also announced it was cutting three routes as part of a wider cost-cutting programme. So what's the future for Shannon Airport? Our reporter Tommy Meskell has been finding out.
We've experienced growth from 2013 up to the end of 2018, where we saw passenger numbers in the airport rise by 34%. the current year, we've seen the impact, particularly the grounding of the MAX jet and the impact that has had, where we lost 13 weekly services over the summer period. But we would be confident when we come through the current turbulence that the aviation sector is in, that would be back on track and we would see that trajectory growing into the future.
For continued climb.
It can cause a rapid change in altitude and direction, so it's no surprise that Mary Considine likens the past year to turbulence. She's CEO of Shannon Group, responsible for operating the state-owned airport.
Well, the fundamentals of route development are all about demand, so the more business activity and the more tourism activity you have in the region, that creates demand for services.
Shannon isn't operating at capacity, is it?
Well, Shannon Airport has terminal capacity of 4.5 million passengers, so we're operating significantly below capacity at the moment.
Shannon has the largest runway in Ireland capable of landing a space shuttle. It's also a diversionary airport, facilitating 95 emergency landings just last year. The airport has opened the Midwest to the world and even the stars, welcoming the likes of Marilyn Monroe and every US president since JFK.
John Tremolta is a regular customer of ours, which is lovely.
The general manager of Dromoland Castle, Mark Nolan.
Clinton and Nelson Mandela, who came to stay with us for two nights.
And many of those people, would they have flown through Shannon?
They would have all have flown through Shannon.
But celebrity aside, Shannon Airport, just 15 minutes from Dromoland, is essential for business.
But what we really need to do is get sustainable European connectivity. Dromoland Castle, we have a huge North American base of our business, but we could even grow that, and the region could grow that business, if we had better European connectivity, because a lot of North Americans will travel into Europe, do a couple of days in Europe, and backtrack through Dublin and through Shannon. Right now, we have no real European connectivity.
On the edge of County Clare is the village of Doolan, home to Anthony Maloney, owner of the Doolan Hostel.
The hostel, we started off in 83, longest family run hostels in Ireland, but sadly in 3 weeks time I'll be closing it. Why? Because Shannon isn't working properly. People like last night, all my guests were from America. So in the next 24 hours they're all going up to Dublin to leave because they couldn't get the flights out. So the first and last day is just about getting access into Ireland and staying. It's great, you get the day tour down, it creates a job, but for every job that it creates, we lose the potential of 20 other jobs.
It's a day trip. We're actually staying in Dublin, and so we took a tour here.
If you were planning your trip again, do you think you might like to stay a bit longer here in Doolan?
We would get a bread and breakfast here. We wouldn't go to Dublin at all.
Did you know that there's an airport here in County Clare?
No, we didn't know.
Doolan isn't a one-off example. A recent report by Copenhagen Economics has found what many have been saying for years. Ireland's economic development is unbalanced. It also finds that aviation policy plays a big role in helping an area to grow.
Katrina Cahill, Chief Economist with Limerick Chamber. The report that we commissioned from Copenhagen Economics in association with Enis Shannon and Galway, we asked them to look at how aviation policy impacts the economies of the West and the Midwest. And what they found was that if you think about Dublin's dominance in the market at the moment, they have somewhere between 86 and 87% of the market share. If you compare that with European countries, the only other small economy similar to Ireland where you see a higher level of market concentration is the Netherlands. But you expect that because Schiphol is obviously one of the most significant EU hubs. The interesting thing, though, is that in the last 10 years, whereas Dublin Airport has increased its market share, Schiphol has actually reduced its market share. If the significant dominance of a capital airport continues, it hinders growth in the regions and it goes against their goal of balanced regional development.
Northern Trust in Limerick employs 1,400 people. Catherine Duffy is its senior vice president.
So we're a financial services firm. Our HQ is in Chicago, so we have a lot of people to and from Chicago. We also have a big office in London and a lot of offices throughout EMEA. And we want people to come live in the region, work in the region, have fun in the region. You know, we say here we have a city job and a country life. Shannon is 30 minutes up the road. It's very important for us to keep it going.
Extension of passengers travelling on Aer Lingus flight to London Heathrow
Heathrow Airport is currently Shannon's only European hub. Brexit could reduce that connectivity to the EU. It's another potential problem for Shannon.
Today, even absence of Brexit, we need connectivity into a European hub. There is very, very strong demand for connectivity today into a European hub.
As part of the budget, a new fund of €2.5 million has been announced by the Department of Transport for regional airports and ports to help them secure new routes. It will be made available next year. Shannon will have to compete with other airports for part of that funding, but it's potentially a chink of light.
It would be support to the airline to underpin the service and provide that connectivity for business and tourism, and that will be very, very important in the context of Brexit.
And that was acting CEO of Shannon Group, Mary Considine, ending that report by Tommy Meskell.
Just over a quarter of Ireland's electricity was generated by wind in the second 3 months of the year, according to a report from the Irish Wind Energy Association. The figure of 27% was up from 22.5% in the same quarter last year. Six new wind farms were connected to the grid between April and June this year. Facebook's nascent cryptocurrency Libra has been dealt a blow by the G7 group of nations. The world's biggest economies have jointly warned that Libra poses a risk to the global financial system. It recommends that the Libra project is shelved until Facebook proves that it's safe and secure. Sterling has largely held on to gains it made against the euro late last week on positive soundings around the prospects of a Brexit deal. The pound made its biggest two-day gain in over 3 years. Against the dollar, however, the pound is down over 0.5% this morning on last week's highs. The euro is trading right now at $1.103 and 87.6 pence sterling.
Will Pascal Donoghue's budget help protect the country from going bust again? Will it help protect the country from the worst excesses of Brexit? Questions for the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council. That's the body set up at the insistence of the Troika, remember them, to try and make sure the same mistakes which led to the last crash aren't repeated. Their chair is UCC economist Seamus Coffey, and we can speak to him now. Seamus Coffey, good morning again.
Good morning.
Your initial thoughts on the budget?
I suppose in overall terms, the government have set out a plan that has to incorporate many different scenarios, that being the economy to perform very strongly in the event that a negotiated deal is arranged for the UK to leave the European Union, and I suppose dealing with the possible consequences of a hard or a crash-out Brexit that could also happen. So the budget is more complicated than usual, perhaps more difficult to analyse, but I think if we look at the general thrust of the budget, the government have set out sort of a reasonable plan in terms of dealing with these two divergent possibilities. Now, one issue that the Fiscal Council has focused on over the last number of years have been overruns in various departments. And this is something that is going to happen again in 2019, just in advance of the budget. The Minister for Finance announced various supplementary estimates, additional spending across a range of departments, most notably the Department of Health, which has happened repeatedly over the last number of years. And this has led to spending increases beyond the plans that the government has set out, and spending increases which are growing at unsustainable rates. Now, in a significant and positive change for 2020, the government have incorporated the overruns for 2019 in their estimate of the budget package for 2020. So previously they had the overruns, did a full budgetary package, and we ended up with those large increases in spending for 2020 in a path as recommended by the Fiscal Council. The government are including those overruns in their estimate of the budget package, and this is a positive and significant step.
But there's no guarantee, as Simon Harris couldn't promise last week, of them not having another supplementary budget for health at some stage next year.
Oh yeah, setting out plans that have a good change is all well and good. Those plans must be delivered on, and we've seen overruns in health now going back over many, many years, and pretty significant overruns. The resources used in the supplementary estimates can sometimes be equivalent to what the Minister has available for his Budget Day speech. So this is some pattern that has to be stopped. You don't expect a budget the size of the government's with spending next year to total around $90 billion to have every line item perfectly correct. But you should have some degree of balance. Some items could be overruns, some items can be underruns, and overall you should be expecting to be close to the issue, to the target. And when it comes to health, it's just repeated overruns, and these have become quite significant.
Pascal Donoghue was very keen to point out last week that in terms of how much extra money is being spent every year, he would say, if you compare it to the last boom, for example, that it's a much slower pace of growth. Now, I know you and others are concerned that the comparisons with the last boom, in other words, that we're spending money, corporation tax money, that we don't know if we can depend upon into the future, is a little bit like spending the money that we got from the housing bubble the last time. Are you reassured by what he did last week?
I think that the change about incorporating the overruns is a positive change. But as I said, we do hope to see these plans deliver true on. And I think with comparisons to the previous boom, a number of caveats must be taken into account. First of all, there was much higher inflation back 15 years ago, which would have funded higher levels of spending. So you must adjust for inflation. And secondly, the 2018 outturn wasn't far off what we saw back in the 2005-06-07 period. The health overruns were much larger, and the increases in spending at 7 or 8% was approaching the levels seen in advance of the previous crash. So we'd hope that the measures taken to address the overruns, particularly in health, and the government have announced a very hands-on approach for health spending from 2020, we hope that that bears fruit and that the plans have set out can be adhered to.
Is it Brexit-proof? Can it be Brexit-proof, to be fair?
I suppose, given the uncertainty, it's quite difficult to achieve that. The government have set out a £1.2 billion package of Brexit contingency measures. Now, some of that has to do with increased unemployment spending, and that should happen. And even if the effect of a crash-out Brexit is larger, there could be even more unemployment-related spending. And that is something that obviously should happen and would be allowed to happen in response to a slowdown in the economy. Then you have about £800 million of Brexit contingency measures. Now, a crucial aspect for the Fiscal Council would be that these measures, if they are to be contingency measures, should be either temporary or one-off. If they are not temporary or one-off, they should be counted as part of ongoing government spending and included in the measure of the budget package. But if they are a Brexit contingency for a hard or crash-out Brexit, and they are dealing with temporary or one-off measures, well, that would be fine. But for some of the industries, they're going through long-term structural issues, and it wouldn't be appropriate to provide permanent supports under the sort of the cover of a hard Brexit. But dealing with the short-term temporary shock of Brexit is entirely appropriate, and the economy should be supported if that's to be the case. We would like to be in a stronger position and not concerned about deficits or debt, and we would have had the opportunity in recent years to put ourselves in a stronger position. But if there is to be a hard Brexit and the economy is to suffer economic shock, the appropriate response is for government support to step in.
Seamus Coffey, thanks very much for speaking to us. That's UCC economist and chair of the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, Seamus Coffey. It's 8:53 now.
We're going to return to that news that Spain's Supreme Court has sentenced 9 Catalan separatist leaders to between 9 and 13 years in prison for their role in the region's 2017 failed bid for independence. Joining us on the line is Rafael Minder, who's a Madrid-based correspondent for the New York Times and author of The Struggle for Catalonia. Can you tell us about these verdicts? Are the sentences as severe as they sound?
Yes, they are. Basically, they're in fact slightly more severe than was expected at the weekend. The only concession made is that the charge of rebellion, which could have landed some of these leaders in prison for as long as 25 years, that rebellion charge has been dropped. But in terms of sedition, the Supreme Court is applying as strict a sentence as is possible under Spanish law. And as expected, only 3 of the 12 defendants will in fact not have to enter prison following the sentence.
What's the reaction likely to be?
Well, there was a big build-up of tension in recent days. Spanish anti-riot police have been deployed in most parts of Catalonia. There was some small incidents at the weekend at the Sants train station in Barcelona. And now we will have to see. The separatist leader of Catalonia has called on people to take to the streets, but has called for any demonstration to be non-violent. We have had a few weeks ago the arrest of a group of hardline militants who have been charged with preparing terrorist acts in Catalonia. So we'll have to see. But I expect a build-up of tension. Certainly people will be out on the streets and gathering around the prisons where these Catalan politicians are held, where they've already actually spent almost 2 years in jail. And it's a tense moment for sure.
Clearly the authorities are bracing themselves for large-scale protests. I was reading that police reinforcements have already been sent to the region.
That's right. Over the last few days, they have deployed extra police in expectation of what might or might not happen once this ruling is handed down, as was the case this morning. So, you know, it may not be that today is the day, but I think we're in the run-up also to a national election next month in Spain. So it's certainly the mix of the Catalan court verdict and the build-up of political campaigning makes for a tense moment.
And have the protests continued over the past couple of years?
There have been some, but overall I would say the independence movement found it hard to regather, if you like. The politicians that are now in charge have not come up with any new plans, new ideas in terms of how they hope to achieve independence in the current context. And obviously, it's been a long time. You cannot expect people to be out on the streets every day for years when they have jobs, families, and other things to worry about. What I would say is that essentially, today's ruling was very much anticipated, but also it was seen as a sort of crux moment. So we will have to see exactly how people react in the coming hours.
Rafael, thank you very much for taking our call this morning. And I see that the former head of Catalonia's regional government, Carles Puigdemont, said that the prison sentences for the separatist leaders were, in his words, an atrocity. On Twitter, he said, "It's time to react for the future of our sons and daughters for democracy." It's 2 minutes to nine.
So, Darren Farrell, Bundiaki's up before the CCCC, yes?
Well, that's one way to put it. He is up this morning. Very important date this morning with the disciplinary panel. I'm not sure what they call it in World Rugby. I think just a disciplinary panel will do for them. An important meeting for him because following a sending off against Samoa at the weekend, it means his World Cup basically is hanging by a thread, because if suspended, then it would end all his involvement for the rest of the Rugby World Cup. Let's get a take on that in a moment, but we're going to pay our usual Monday morning visit during this World Cup tournament and hear from Don Lennon in Japan in a moment. His thoughts on New Zealand and the force that is Japanese rugby. Weren't they fantastic yesterday morning? But first, his thoughts on this disciplinary hearing and how it will go for Bundiaki.
It's a very difficult one. I felt at the time that there was some mitigating circumstances in terms of the Samoan out half was dipping, was falling into the tackle, if you like. And since then, the Irish management have forensically gone through the video footage of it. Their timing, his reaction time and making the tackle at 0.2 of a second, you automatically have a hearing to adjudicate on a potential suspension. The Irish management can use that opportunity to put up a defence for his actions. And as we know, they've flown out legal counsel to aid that process. There's been so much criticisms of referees out here during the World Cup, and World Rugby have thrown the officials under the bus so often. I'm not sure if they're prepared to do it again and admit it could have been a yellow card offence as opposed to red. I think he'll be lucky if they do rescind it, but I think they're right to go through the process.
New Zealand waiting for us next Saturday. I think it was the one when this World Cup journey started out, we didn't want. But how are you feeling now that it's real, it's going to happen next weekend?
They would have preferred South Africa primarily on the basis that they get an extra day's rest and an extra day's preparation. And their recent history against South Africa has been very good. But that said, if you want to win a World Cup, you're going to have to beat New Zealand at some stage. And our recent history against them has been pretty impressive. We've won two of the last three outings. A lot of the players were involved in the Lions series in 2017 when they won one test and drew the second one. You know, from a confidence perspective and a belief perspective, I don't think that's going to be an issue. With the change in the weather conditions and the humidity and the temperatures dropping, you could see, certainly from a physical perspective, Ireland were back playing at the levels they were far more comfortable in the conditions that they faced in Fukuoka. You know, I think they'll relish the challenge and you just have to go and give it your best shot.
Final word on Japan. They were fantastic on Sunday. could we all learn a lesson from what these guys are doing over there?
There's no doubt about it. I think they're reshaping the way rugby can be played. They're disproving the theory that, you know, you all have to be 18, 19 stone men to play in this, in what has become an ultra-physical game. You really have to be out here to appreciate the damage that Typhoon Hagibis has created in and around the Tokyo area. So for the game to go ahead last night in itself was an achievement. But I thought that the minute silence before the game was incredibly emotional. And the manner with which Japan played, particularly in that opening half, they just blew Scotland off the park. They're a joy to watch. So I think we're in for a fantastic weekend of action, and we'll wait and see what happens.
Yeah, I think the tournament really just begins, doesn't it? It kicks into life hopefully next weekend with those quarterfinals, all mouth-watering prospects, all those games live on RTE television, and of course the Irish game live on RTE Radio 1 also. 11:15 kickoff, so join us here on Radio 1 for that. Now, and soccer, big week for the Irish soccer team as well, and the Irish manager Mick McCarthy says he is open to starting Aaron Connolly for the European qualifier against Switzerland tomorrow. This follows the news that Dave McGoldrick is not available because of a groin injury. Now, the maths quite simple here. We have two games left. This one away to the Swiss tomorrow, then we're home against Denmark next month, and if we win one of those matches, we progress to the 2020 final. So draws no good at this stage. We have to beat one of those two teams. The Irish manager has been speaking to FEI TV and he's dropped the biggest hint yet, that he's considering giving 19-year-old Connolly his chance.
He had his cameo at the end. And then, of course, then the question is, well, could I have played him more? Well, yeah, I could have started him and he might not have played very well from the start in a rough and tumble game. He might have scored from the start. All those scenarios, but had he started and not played well, then that would have been, well, shouldn't have had a debut, usual stuff, which I know is coming. Whatever, it doesn't matter what happens, you'll get picked holes on whatever happens. I think he was great when he came on and he had his chances in a game that was starting to get stretched. It was starting to become wide open. But for, you know, I think a real bobbly pitch with his other one on his left foot, it just ran away from him. So he's had a really good cameo appearance and I no doubt he's ready to start.
Yeah, I've no doubt he is. Let's see what happens tomorrow evening. 7:45 start, and this game live on RT2 and also on 2FM. Fionnuala McCormack has qualified for the Olympic Games with her fifth place finish at the Chicago Marathon. The time, a personal best, 2 hours 26.47 seconds. Incredible stuff from Fionnuala there. And her performance came on the day that Bridget Koshsky smashed the women's world record, winning that race in 2 hours 14.04 seconds. Incredible running from everyone involved there. And I guess while we're on that subject of Olympics, we have to mention Reese
McClenaghan.
Well,
what a performance.
Incredible.
For people who may have missed this over the weekend, because there was such an emphasis, understandably, on team sport over the weekend, Ireland had a gymnast who got a bronze medal at the World Championships, which is quite something else. I mean, nothing like it has ever happened before for a foreign Irish gymnast. Reese McClenaghan is his name. He's qualified for the Olympics, as I understand it.
Yes.
And when you watch what he did, by God, it's difficult.
It is difficult. He was on the pommel horse at the weekend, Rachel, and phenomenal stuff. I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on this, but just the strength, but also the skill he had on that pommel was incredible. What I would like to point out is he has a European medal. He's the gold medalist last year. And also the chap who won the gold medal at the weekend, Max Whitlock, he is the defending Olympic champion. And I think Reese is going to give him a run for his money next summer.
Wouldn't
Let's
it
hope
be brilliant?
He is. Oh, it's going to be fantastic. Let's wish him and congratulate him and wish him all the best. I want to finish up with Gaelic Games. 16 county finals. So many great stories, I have to say. There really is. You couldn't highlight one without going into all of them, to be honest. But you can read all about those great stories on the RTÉ News Now app and on the RTÉ website. We cover the games on Sunday Sport yesterday. I just want to pick out one moment that highlights the county finals for me and the pressure on and pride of the parish and everything like that. Glen Carr Hamilton's 1-point win in the Leitrim county final. Just picture the scene. 5 minutes into injury time, a tough angle, free kick, last kick of the game. And it's a moment like this where you want your captain to step up to the plate and deliver.
It's a very, very tricky angle. There's little or no breeze, and he's going to kick it out of his hands. We're in the fifth minute of stoppage time. Up steps Conor Dolan, and over it goes.
Look, to be honest, I'm absolutely speechless. I can't say enough about this team. This is my fourth final to play, and it's my first to win. We were written off, I suppose, all year. Nobody gave us a chance. It's a hugely successful club, and I have to say I'm a very proud man to captain them here today.
Well, you can tell it in his voice. Conor Dolan there speaking after a 1-point win for his club, Glencairn Manor Hamilton, over Ballinamore.